Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now, teenage ISIS brides and the pull of radicalisation may not immediately be thought of as a source of comedy, but peacebuilding practitioner and advisor turned writer Nuseiba Yunus has focused her sharp eye on this world and has written a darkly hilarious novel called Fundamentally about a chaotic academic, Nadia, who heads to Iraq intent on de-radicalising these young girls, and she joins us now. Nuseiba, you're very, very welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So look, you've had this really, really interesting and sterling career from Oxford to Harvard and then on to a task force in Iraq. There is a huge legal disclaimer at the outset of the book. This is fiction. But I just wonder how much of this book draws on your own personal experience.
Yeah, well, it was very important to have that legal disclaimer right up front.
There is no resemblance.
Couldn't be like, hey, why am I in this? I was working in Baghdad as a peacebuilding practitioner, and I was asked to design a program to de-radicalize ISIS brides. And when I visited a refugee camp in Anbar province and met some of the young women who were believed to be affiliated with ISIS, I had such a sort of shocking realization that I could have ended up in their position. I'd grown up in the UK in a very religious household, but I was also very politically active, you know, really against the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. And I studied with a preacher who I adored, called Anwar Olalaki. Not a super attractive guy, but I was really into him. And, you know, luckily I was not a very compelling 15-year-old. So he did not try and take me with him when he joined Al-Qaeda. But if he had tried, I could have been game.
It's kind of like a sliding doors moment. But just to dwell on a moment on your own background, because you're a young Muslim woman, you're growing up in a religious family, and you're like many young people, you're watching these wars, whether it's Chechnya, Afghanistan, Iraq, and you're sort of drawn to this, and you're trying to, you know, to help people. Did going over there kind of as a peace builder and tasked with designing this program to de-radicalize young women, did that give you an insight into the ideology that drove these girls?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what was extraordinary is, you know, me working for international NGOs in the Middle East, you know, trying to bring peace to the region, I was motivated by very similar reasons as the young women who had joined ISIS, who also saw war in the Middle East and who wanted to do something to help. I was just fortunate enough that I was able to grow up and have an education and go to university and realize that terrorist groups are not the best way to bring peace to the Middle East. But I can totally imagine at 15 years old, when someone tells you not to believe the news because it's all propaganda, and actually that these types of groups are really trying to help Muslims, I can understand why at a young age you might be susceptible to believe that. And I thought it was such an interesting premise for a novel to imagine me as I am now, sort of an adult in my 30s, working for international institutions, trying to help Iraq, and coming face to face with a version of me at 15 who had also ended up going to Iraq from the UK, but on the side of a terrorist group, but also trying to do the same thing.
So I imagine that kind of
dialogue and banter and arguments between those two characters.
So what do you think, Nuseiba, prevented you from following those extremist teachings, gone off with that guy that you were thankfully not really into? You know, because, you know, there are two people who are equally influenced by, you know, major global events, and one takes one path and one takes another.
Yeah, I was really ugly when I was 15, I'm not going to lie. So I think if I had been really gorgeous, then someone might have tried to radicalise me to marry them and go and join the cohort of ISIS.
It cannot be true. I do not believe that.
But it's fine. I've had a glow up. It's fine. No, I think honestly, I was just lucky that nobody, when I was at my most vulnerable to believing propaganda, I was lucky that nobody tried to radicalise me in that exact moment. And that's what I think is so extraordinary, because we think of ISIS brides as being monsters, as people who want to hurt people. But actually, I think what made me so vulnerable to radicalisation at that age was actually my empathy. Like, I had such a bleeding heart and was so moved by suffering in other parts of the world that I could have been manipulated easier than someone who just didn't care, you know, about suffering or didn't care what was happening on the other side of the world.
Yeah, it made me even think just of, you know, the island of Ireland here and why young people back in the day got involved in the conflict, how I suppose how vulnerable, but also just how exposed to ideas we are, you know, during our teenage years when we're exploring our independence and our autonomy and our perceived strength. And at the same time, you're only a child.
Yeah, well, this is partly what made the book so funny and so enjoyable to write, because teenagers think they know everything. And when I imagined, oh my God, writing the kind of things that my teenage self would say was just painful and embarrassing and hilarious. Because you have such a sense when you're 15 of being an adult, when actually you're not.
You're not, but you think it, and you're in that sort of twilight zone between adolescence and adulthood. Let's bring you back to the comedy, because a book about such a serious topic, about radicalisation, ISIS brides, should not be this laugh out loud funny or, dare I say, as naughty and as crude in parts. I spat out tea at one line, which I'm not going to read out. Why did you want to tell this story as comic fiction? Would you, you know, because you could have written this as a serious academic who'd been in Iraq, who'd, you know, witnessed this firsthand. Why did you choose comic fiction rather than something academic?
I just love comedy. I love reading comic novels. I love stand-up. I love watching funny TV. And my vision for this book was I wanted to write Fleabag meets In the Thick of It, but in Baghdad. That sort of hot mess girl character in her 30s who screwed everything up, who then ends up being inserted into a mad bureaucracy where her colleagues are incompetent and also extremely horny and inappropriate. I thought that would just be such a fun and engaging way to tell the story. But I also thought it's very truthful, because we think of the United Nations and international NGOs in quite a rarefied way. But actually, they're just dysfunctional institutions like all institutions, made up of people who are messy and who are struggling with personal drama and emotional conflict, and who are bringing all of that to work, except the stakes are so much higher when you're dealing with big geopolitical problems.
I love the bit where kind of Nadia, she's sent in to save these girls and she arrives in Baghdad and she's absolutely appalled that that the buildings are working, that there's a functioning nightlife, you know, and she's kind of, you know, where is my, you know, my total kind of trauma. Before we get on to Nadia's character, can I bring you back to your real world? First of all, what was it like for you in Iraq when you first met these young girls? Like, I mean, were you afraid of them? Did you see them as sort of fanatical terror operatives? Or what did you see when you met them?
Yeah, I actually was quite afraid. I was nervous to meet women who, you know, have been accused of being affiliated to ISIS. I was definitely afraid. And then the moment I met them, I was like, oh God, I realised that they were just ordinary young women. And I realised just how much I could empathise with how they'd ended up there. And there are so many different stories. So yes, some people were radicalised, you know, when they were very young.
Yeah, what drives these girls?
People, There were other people who had just been forced into it by family members, by husbands, by men. There were many Iraqi women who, you know, ISIS had just shown up in their towns and villages and taken the women that they wanted. And that was the end of that, and had no choice at all. And so there were men, and of course there were, and of course there were, there are occasionally women who are very ideologically committed, you know, to an extremist ideology, and those women are scary. Yeah. So it was quite a variety of different stories to get my head around.
So it could have been like, you know, a kid who rebels in the family, or idealism. Do you think there was also, apart from that huge, you know, coercion where they don't have a choice, but is there sort of also just a coercion in the form of peer pressure?
Yeah, I mean, there's a line in the book where I sort of refer to a lot of these girls as girls who've lost control of their gap years. Because there's the sense that, you know, a lot of young women and boys want to go off and establish their independence and explore an identity for themselves that they've built for themselves, and also want to be a hero. And I think a lot of the book actually is deconstructing the idea of what it means when you want to go to somebody else's country and be a hero. And I actually draw some parallels. Yeah, some parallels between the UN staff who've shown up in Iraq trying to be heroes, whether or not the Iraqis want that, and, you know, these young British girls who've joined ISIS thinking that they're going to save the world.
Like, I mean, there is a, it was comic but also heartbreaking. There's a line, Nusaybe in the book, where it says, "My heart broke thinking of Sarah at 15 showing up to a war zone armed only with chocolate."
Yeah, there were so many stories of young men and women from the UK who were just going to Syria to join ISIS, and the only thing they could think to pack was sort of suitcases full of dairy milks, because they'd heard that it was hard to get chocolate out there. And it just, I think it just really puts into stark relief how little these teenagers understood about what they were signing up for. And then once they were there, it was a path of no return.
And they couldn't. I just kind of think that sort of inspires just a certain amount of fear and terror when you think of it. Were you nervous, Nusaybe, kind of about writing about a topic? And obviously you were deploying comedy as a huge part of that. But the topic around de-radicalisation, the topic around, you know, these young ISIS brides, particularly in the UK with high profile cases like Shamina Begum, you know, the young ISIS bride who was stripped of her UK citizenship, it evokes a lot of divisive opinion. And we are talking about teenage girls, you know, especially at a time when people say, you know, that the adolescent brain doesn't probably mature until our 20s.
Yeah, I thought writing a novel was such a good way to get people into a space of empathy, because, you know, even I, as someone who did grow up as a religious Muslim, even I was afraid, right, of the idea of meeting so-called ISIS women. And it took me actually going into those tents and talking to those women to realise that they were just such a diverse and different set of human beings, and each individual needed to be understood on their own terms. And I think the novel is a way for people who've only understood this topic in terms of a set of headlines to be able to go deeper and to hang out, you know, over the course of 300 pages and getting to know individual people. And there is no whitewashing in this novel. The women are complicated, and they're not what you want them to be, and they fight back, and they have agency, and they're funny, and they make horrendous sex jokes, and, you know, they're
really
just the full complexity.
Horrendous. I think that's what I was laughing out loud at some parts. But for all of the comedy, and the comedy is brilliant, it's such a clever device, but it helps sort of, you manage the whipsaw, if I can say it, Nusaybe, in your brain when you come to the parts where you do ask really, really significant political questions. You know, so at one point in the book, fundamentally, there, you know, there is those rhetorical questions. What's the appropriate punishment for ISIS brides who didn't commit any violent crimes? Can we detain people just because of their beliefs? And should we try and change their beliefs? In real life, the programme that you designed, the de-radicalisation programme, never came to fruition, I think. But what was your, getting into that more, I guess, that serious political space and looking what happened in the UK, what is your understanding of how we should treat these young girls and men, given the various different routes that they've gone through in order to find themselves as ISIS brides?
Yeah, I think it's crucial that we take these individuals on a case-by-case basis and really, I think, first of all, British citizens should absolutely be repatriated to the UK. And I can't believe I'm in agreement with President Trump on this. I think it's concerning when President Trump is telling you that you're in the wrong for abandoning your citizens to another country who should not be responsible for them. And I think that they, as individuals, should be tried in UK courts of law, according to what they've done. But I think one of the interesting things I really learned when I was working on this issue is the difference between de-radicalisation and demobilisation. And I think this has relevance to the Irish context as well, where it's sort of pointless and can be counterproductive to try and change people's beliefs. People really hate being told what they have to believe. And if you try and shove your belief system down somebody else's throat, it's not effective, it's probably unethical, and it doesn't work. But what you can do, and what's really important to do, is to demobilize people. So that means to change people's behavior. And you can set up contexts in which people desist from violence without actually changing people's ideologies at all. And that's about giving people better options in life. And it's partly about reinserting them into supportive community and especially family contexts where people have something to live for and they have a life that they're building and they have a purpose that they can believe in. Without even changing somebody's religious ideology at all, you can actually create a context in which they are not violent and they're not a threat.
And as you say, there is a spectrum of belief and commitment to those beliefs, right up from just perhaps peer pressure to actually offending and belief in a cause. But a lot of these young ISIS brides do need psychological help, that they have perhaps been exposed to trauma. They may be post-traumatic and I suppose at a human level, they need help. But of course, if we're labelling them all in the one manner, especially if, you know, I'm just trying to think back to my own 15-year-old self, you know, a lot of it sounds like a process of grooming.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that psychological support is going to be really important if we were to repatriate some of these women, not least because practically all of them have been sexually abused. You know, there was not a huge amount of choice in who these women were, who they would marry and what took place in those marriages. And they were very young and often had multiple husbands, as husbands would die on the battlefield and they would be put back sort of on the marriage market. And yeah, I think that sexual coercion and abuse and domestic violence, in addition to being part of a war zone, losing children, you know, perhaps being like physically hurt in the violence themselves, a huge amount of trauma that these women have been through. And yeah, psychological support would be absolutely crucial.
But you were very careful, I think, particularly Sarah, who is the young ISIS bride. You didn't make her into a victim. You know, she does sort of give as good as she gets. Were you conscious that you weren't trying to fall into tropes around the treatment of ISIS brides and their repatriation, which is a deeply political issue?
Yeah, I honestly, in the book, I just really wanted to tell the truth. I am not telling the reader what they have to think about this issue. I'm just laying out what it is actually like to go to Iraq to meet these women and to try and figure out what the right thing to do is. And you have the chance to make up your own mind about, you know, in a sea of quite bad options, what you think might be the right thing to do. But I think, you know, often ISIS brides are portrayed either as sole victims who have just been groomed and are sort of without agency altogether, or on the other side are monsters, are ideological monsters who like hate the West or whatever. And I wanted to create a much more realistic character, which is someone who's very complicated, you know, who, yes, is a victim because of their age and because they were very young when they were targeted, but and also is someone who has very strong ideological beliefs that we don't agree with and is a complicated person who has a voice and has her own worldview that we might struggle with, actually. And I thought that was a much more realistic depiction. You know, I'm not trying to pretend that these women are not complicated, and that the choices we have before us are all good choices. They're not. And I'm trying to be really honest about that.
Yeah, it's not all sort of clean lines. You embrace the messy stuff. You were very serious about making the book funny. You took a course in stand-up comedy.
Yeah, you know when you pick up books and they say on the front, hilarious or funny, and then you don't laugh a single time when you read that book. I feel so outraged when a book that claims to be funny isn't funny. I really want to go and get a refund. And so I was determined that if it said funny on the front of my book, that you would laugh out loud, snort on public transport,
which
embarrass I have yourself, you know, that your husband would come into the room and say, what's so funny? You know, I wanted it to be properly funny. And the best way to do that, I thought, was just to tell the jokes on stage.
Stress test them out.
People can tell you it's funny afterwards. But the real question is, when you tell the story on stage, people either laugh or they don't. Yeah. The laughter is quite a brutal verdict on your joke.
And it's such an interesting pivot to have had that big, you know, academic and this illustrious career, and then just pivot into comic writing. But I wanted to chat to you about, you just mentioned it earlier, that fundamentally is as much a satire about working in the UN as much as anything else. And, you know, we do have this notion of very well educated, you know, very well resourced, very serious people going in to save souls. But this really counteracts that image. So spill the tea for us, Nusaybe. What is the reality of NGOs and the UN?
Well, it's sort of how you would imagine any big complicated bureaucracy, just completely maddening. You never know who wants what, and different agencies have very different goals that are often at odds with each other. But even more complicated than an ordinary big institution, you know, like the civil service, at the top of the United Nations, you have different member states who want different things. And so at the very top, the people steering the work of this huge behemoth institution across many countries is, you know, a group of member states who are actually driving often in opposite directions. And especially on this issue of ISIS brides, there isn't agreement. You know, there are fundamental differences between different people at the very top. And so what that leads to is often just chaos and contradictions and confusions at the working level.
And the amusement or otherwise of the actual citizens looking at all of these people coming in and telling them what to do. And I think that it really captures that. I obviously timing is everything, and it's really, really interesting that, you know, the recent dismantling of US aid obviously is something that's very, very topical. And I just thought that in its own way fundamentally does shine a light on the efficacies or perhaps the robustness of the international aid and donor system.
Yeah, it's quite unfortunate timing, really. I completely disagree with the way that the Trump administration has dismantled USAID. USAID was providing life-saving support to some of the poorest countries in the world, including direct food aid, water, sanitation, like actual life-saving support. And the removal of that funding has directly put people's lives at risk. And I think that is outrageous and just, you know, I think unjustifiable. At the same time, there are also clearly problems in the international aid industry. Mm. You know, there are many programs that are nonsensical. There's huge waste of money. And, you know, the Trump administration has identified a problem.
Like that administration
has been able to do in a lot of ways. It's identified a problem and then it's come in with a sledgehammer
for the solution
and has had a completely idiotic response to that problem. So, you know, I don't think our answer to that is to say that USAID and the aid industry is perfect and didn't need reform. There are absolutely in the book showcases, there are so many inefficiencies and there are so many stupid things that are funded and that shouldn't be. But also there are great programs that need continued support. And yeah.
And great, speaking of great programs, there was a stunning 8-way auction for the TV rights to Fundamentally. Can I ask you just a personal question before I let you go, Nusaybha? This book is about many things. It's going to spark many different conversations, but I suppose at the heart of it is exploring that notion of belief, how our beliefs change, how they are tested, and belief in all its sort of mystical and messy forms. You grew up in a very religious household. Do you still have your faith?
I mean, I believe in the gods of TV who are going to make this book into a show.
Fair enough.
And I pray to them every day that we get to broadcast.
But it's an interesting question. But unfortunately, I'm going to have to let you go, Nusay, because I'm not going to be able to. It's still the answer, but we leave it hanging there for the next time. But for now, Fundamentally is published by Weidenfield and Nicholson, and it is out now. But for now, Nusaybha Yunus, thank you for joining us, and best of luck with
the
TV. All the best. We'll take a quick break.